In the history of Numenor and its descendant culture Gondor, a lineage of iconic white trees stands as the symbolic and spiritual center of Numenorean culture. How many of these trees were there? Where did they come from? And what was their significance? Join us as we explore the history of the white trees of Gondor. The Tolkien Road, Episode 211, The White Trees of Gondor. Hello everyone, welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 211. On this episode, we're going to do a deep dive on the history of the White Tree of Gondor and the role it plays in the history of Numenor and its descendants. How does that sound, Greta?
It sounds pretty fantastic.
Awesome.
Really cool.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah, so this has been a topic that has interested me for a long time, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, things gonna be great.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so we're waiting for our long intro music to play out and just, you know, kind of finding things to randomly spout about. There we go. All right, hey, what's up, everybody? So let's talk about Patreon, because you know we're going to. We always talk about Patreon at the beginning of the episodes. We want you all to become patrons. If you're listening to this, we want you to become a patron, right? We are asking you to become a patron today and help us continue to build this podcast into something that gets better and better with each episode, that gets better and better with each week. And you can have a stake in that by becoming a patron, right? So head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road and learn more about how you can contribute to what we're doing over here. So we highly appreciate those of you who already contribute, who have contributed in the past. And like I said, we want every person to listen to this.
Yeah.
We want to earn your patronage, right?
We do.
So,
and every little bit helps.
If you love this podcast and you're not currently a patron, ask yourself, gosh darn it. Or maybe I should say
Darn Garshnard.
Why am I not a patron of the Tolkien Road
Why
podcast?
Not? Why not?
Yeah.
Is there a good reason? And there might be.
Yeah.
But at least ask the question.
You need to search that soul a little bit.
Exactly.
You know.
Do some introspective searching.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Please leave us a 5-star rating and say some nice things about us. So leaving 5 stars and a review helps get the word out about us. So please, if nothing else, head on over and do that. So,
yeah.
Tolkien news of Tolkiendom. So the first thing I want to say is that I have posted a new video on the Tolkien Road YouTube channel on Tolkien versus the Nazis. So this is, you might recall, we did an episode on Tolkien versus the Nazis about 14 or 15 episodes ago. And so that was a long discussion of the topic, and I wanted to do, and so this video is just me, and I wanted to do just a short, like 5-minute-ish video on this topic so that it would be more easily shareable with anybody who this might come up in conversation with, for all of you people who love Tolkien like we do. And for some reason, this is just a thing that always comes up with Tolkien. And I think it has to do with his fascination with, like the quote unquote Nordic culture, with the Northern European cultures, it's the ancient Northern European cultures, and the way that, and the fact that he lived during the same time as the Nazis were sort of trying to co-op, in a very unjust way, trying to co-op a lot of that mythology for their own purposes. And so I wanted to make a video that really was, you know, got to the heart of, like, just saying, like, look, Tolkien was anti-Nazi before most others were, right? Tolkien was hating on those dudes, on Hitler and all the Hitlerites, way before a lot of other people were. So this video is all about that. I hope you'll share it far and wide, and, you know, get the word out so that, you know, this whole idea that Tolkien was somehow had some affinity for their ideology, we can just get rid of that. We can just squash that. So Yeah, so check that video out.
It's on YouTube?
It's on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. And while you're over there, of course, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Trying to get the ball rolling on doing more and more videos. We got our intro to the Silmarillion series over there, and then we got this video on Tolkien versus the Nazis, and I've got some other videos planned that I'm working on.
Cool. So, yeah. Well, subscribe.
Absolutely.
So you can be in the loop.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's another, hey, you know what? So my patrons, you all can also kind of feel like this is something you all contributed to, you know, and making, helping me make these videos. Right. And so this would be another thing I'd say for supporting us via Patreon is the more support we have via Patreon, the more I can devote my time to doing things like that, making videos, writing future books, all of those kinds of things. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Help us out.
Yes, please.
Hey, and then we do have a little bit of news on the Latron Prime front as well this week.
That's exciting.
Of course, no internet. What is it? Come on. Yeah, there we go. That's what I thought, internet. All right, so the news is that Latron Prime has apparently gotten the green light to resume production in New Zealand. So as with everything else in this magnificent year of 2020, Latron Prime got the production work got shut down in New Zealand because of the coronavirus. But apparently it has resumed as of September 30th, which we're recording on October 2nd. So
yeah, just a couple days ago.
Yeah, so just a couple of days ago it resumed production. So that's fantastic news. Makes me feel hopeful that we are going to, in fact, maybe see this in 2021. So
I don't think that's too far-fetched.
So the other part of this is it seems to be confirmed that they've already really completed the first two episodes, actually, that they may have come close to completely having them in the can, like before the coronavirus shutdown happened. So, you know, I just really hope, at the very least, we're going to start seeing news about, like, real news about this, like hype news about this, right? Not just like, well, somebody said that somebody else said that somebody else said, right? And there's these rumors going around that we have all these characters we don't know anything about who are, you know, these actors playing these characters. Like, it's time to get excited, right? Like, let's transition into the getting the fans pumped up for this, because you know we're waiting. So.
Yeah, I think the time is right.
Absolutely.
To drop some news.
Yeah, especially, you know, come on. I mean, 2020 has already been bad enough. Let's have some cool news.
Throw us a bone.
That's right. So yeah, that's all the news from Tolkiendom that I've got this week. If you've got any tips on news, send them our way and we will do our best to share them. And stick around to the end of the episode for some correspondence. All right, Greta, you ready to talk about the white trees of Gondor?
Yeah, I know Tolkien loves them, some trees, so.
Absolutely.
I do, too.
Let's do it. Okay, so on this episode, we're taking a look at the white trees of Gondor. The white trees of Gondor. That is a plural.
More than one.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Greta, but I'm always losing track of the history of the white tree, or really the white trees, so I thought this would be a great topic for a one-off episode, because this is kind of... It's this lore that is within the stories of Middle Earth, and you get the sense that it's all connected, this history of this white tree, especially because of the importance of the two trees of Valinor going all the way back to the beginning.
Right. Yeah.
But it's not always clear how it all connects together. When we were doing the history of the Third Age series, you know, we read a good bit about some of the, you know, that there were actually different white trees of Gondor. And then when you read A Calibeth and other stories of the Second Age, the history of Numenor, you realize how important the Nimloth was. Nimloth, the white tree of Numenor. So I wanted to do a episode just on that topic in particular and really make sure, like, you know, just have one place stop to understand the history of the white tree. So.
Yeah, sounds great.
That is the plan.
Cool.
So the white tree is best known from Lord of the Rings, first as the dead tree that Pippin sees in the court of the Fountain of Minas Tirith just before his meeting with Denethor. So I think this is kind of a memorable scene from the film, from Peter Jackson's films, when you're up in that higher place in Minas Tirith and you see this tree that's obviously got a central place in this courtyard, but it's dead. And then... It's also well known as being the sapling discovered on the slopes of Mendoluin by Gandalf and Aragorn like after the destruction of the One Ring, so pretty late in the Lord of the Rings. But to really understand the significance of the White Tree, you've got to go way back, right? You got to go much further back than Lord of the Rings, and much further back even than the Third Age. So the genealogy of the White Tree goes all the way back to the Two Trees of Valinor, kind of. All right?
Kind of.
The truth is that there are, unfortunately, no tree... Well, I shouldn't say no trees, but there are... It's not a direct connection, necessarily. As you probably recall, the Two Trees of Valinor were destroyed, murdered by Melkor and Ungoliant, which is the major catastrophe that sets the events of the Silmarillion in motion, right? So you go back to the Darkening of Valinor. It's this really tragic thing. The Two Trees of Valinor are literally the source of light for the entire world at that point, right? Mm-hmm. There's no sun, there's no moon. The Two Trees of Valinor, they are the source of light for the entire world. It's this, like, it's not just light. It's not physical. It's not just physical light. It's like spiritual light too, right? Mm-hmm. They're glorious. They're beautiful. And they're like the pride of Valinor, right? So, and in fact, it's the light of these two trees that is what the Silmarils themselves contain, okay? So those two trees were Laurelin, the golden tree, and Telperion, the silver tree. And so Telperion's flower became the moon, right? Telperion, there's one flower that survives from Telperion, and it becomes the moon. And of course, one of Laureline's fruits becomes the sun.
And that's before Melkor murders it?
Well, it's just that those are the only two things that survive from the two trees.
Oh, those two
right?
flowers. I see.
The flower from Telperion, okay. And then the fruit from Laurelin.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
So then we jump forward a little bit to Galathelion, which was a copy of Telperion made by Yavanna for the elves of Tirion. It looked exactly like Telperion, but it gave no light of its own. All right, so Galathelion, it was like a carbon copy of Telperion, the silver tree, right? But it didn't have that same light, okay? So you're never going to have the light of the two trees again, right? You're never going to have two trees like those, okay? That's apparently... within the lore of Middle-earth, that's an impossible thing. But in terms of its overall look, apart from the light, that special light it gave off, Galathelion is a perfect... It looks exactly the same as Telperion.
So it's more of a symbol, really? I mean, does it serve any functional purpose? Or is it just more of like a memorial,
well,
almost?
I think don't ever forget in Tolkiendom, in Tolkien lore, that symbols are very important things, right?
True. I did not mean to...
symbols are functional,
to talk
right?
Down about
in Tolkien's view
that's
of things.
True.
Right?
That's true.
And I think anybody who doesn't just have a really like cynical and ultra materialistic view of the world... I don't want to put down materialists necessarily. I'm just saying I think we can all understand the power of symbols, right? Mm-hmm. The symbols are actually functional, right? Now, I think we can think in like mechanistic sense that like, oh, well, it's not plowing my fields for me. How is it functional, right?
We know how Tolkien felt about that.
Well, yeah. Well, then, yeah. So symbols are functional things,
they
right?
Are. Yes.
So Galathelion was a copy of Telperion made by Yavanna for the elves of Tirion, right? It looked exactly like Telperion, but it gave no light of its own. And then Galathelion's seedling was Celeborn, which flourished in Tol Eressëa. Now, don't get confused.
Yes,
between
that's
Celeborn.
A person too, right?
Yeah. So Celeborn is, of course, the husband of Galadriel.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
The father of, or the grandfather of Arwen, and so they just happen to have the same name, right? So
okay. There's
two different Celeborns. One is a tree, and one is an elf.
But they're pronounced the same.
Yes, as far as I know.
Okay.
So Celeborn flourished in Tol Eressëa. So Tirion, right, just so we can get our first age geography correct. All right, Tirion was a city actually within the within the Blessed Realm. Looks like the internet. Oh, there we go. Back up. Okay. Internet went down there momentarily. Yeah, so Tirion, known fully as Tirion upon Tuna, was the city of the Noldor and Aman. It was from here that Finwë ruled and where his sons Fëanor, Fingolfin, and Finarfin ruled, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Tirion is the city of the Noldor, and that's where Galathelion resides. And then Celeborn resides on Tol Eressëa, which is the Lonely Island, right? And it's the island, actually, that is visible from Numenor, or mm-hmm. at least the kind of the glow of it is visible from Numenor.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So it's like the first place you'll hit on your journey to Valinor from the Middle Earth. So Celeborn. So do you see? So no tree is actually descended from the two trees, right? Directly. Okay. All we have left of the two trees are the sun and the moon. Right, those are mm-hmm. Those are the only things directly descended from
mm-hmm.
the two trees of Valinor in Tolkien's legendarium. But Galathelion is the carbon copy of the silver tree Telperion, right? And then Celeborn is descended from Galathelion. And so when we get to the Second Age, and they make a big deal about this Nimloth, okay? Nimloth was a seedling of Celeborn. All right, so Galathelion begets Celeborn, begets Nimloth, right? We're talking like some weird tree biblical genealogy, right?
Yeah, right.
Nimloth was a seedling of Celeborn and was brought to Numenor by the Eldar of Tol Eressëa as a symbol of friendship between the two races. So that's the origin of Nimloth, right? It's a symbol.
It came from Galathelion.
Galathelion. Right.
And that was, again, not a direct descendant of the two trees. It was just a carbon. It was like a clone.
Just a carbon copy, right?
Yeah. So it was a clone minus the light.
Minus the light.
Now, it says it gave no light of its own,
mm-hmm.
right? But did it reflect, like, was there light that it reflected or?
Well, yeah, but that's how everything normally works, right? I mean, I don't want to get like all into physics here, but like, you think of like the light of the moon, right? The light of the moon is reflecting the light of the sun,
right?
Right, back
yeah.
onto Earth, and without that light from the sun, it would be very dark, right? Mm-hmm. It'd be very hard. I mean, I think in physics terms, everything gives off some amount of light, whether it be minuscule or a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in kind of natural terms, like certain things are going, you know, certain things are going to give off so little light that it's almost like they're giving off no light. Right.
Okay.
So, I mean, yes. So Galathelion would have given off some minuscule amount of light. The point is that it did not give off the light that Telperion gave off.
It did not have the same light that's contained within the
And probably most importantly is the spiritual light, right? You know, that
mm-hmm.
kind of, that light of glory that only the two trees were capable of giving.
So what do you think Yavanna's purpose was in making this tree for the elves?
Well, I think it was just meant to be a gift for them, right? It was meant to be. So it would seem that these trees, you know, whether it be Galathelion, Celeborn, or Nimloth, represent some kind of friendship with...
Between the Valar and the elves.
With Valinor, right? So Galathelion mm-hmm. was a symbol of affection and friendship between the Valar and the Noldor,
mm-hmm.
right? Celeborn okay. was a symbol of friendship between the Valinor and the people of Tol Eressëa, who I think were mostly Teleri. And then Nimloth was a symbol of friendship between the mm-hmm. Eldar of Tol Eressëa and Numenor. So these are,
mm-hmm.
you know, these trees represent friendship,
mm-hmm.
affection between the Blessed Realm and the peoples of the Blessed
okay.
Realm, you know, kind of, and kind of spreading out into the rest of the world. Right.
Gotcha. Yeah, so it's just like a way to remind them
mm-hmm.
that the Valar, while absent a lot of the time, like physically absent, are still present. You know, they're still present in the sense that, in the spiritual sense, in the offering of their support mm-hmm. and care and protection and all those things.
Right.
So it's like a visible reminder.
Right.
To the elves.
Yeah, I mean,
the Valar's got their back.
It crosses my mind that you could almost think of it like... you know, when in the Old Testament with the Ark of the Covenant, right? So being, mm-hmm. you know, being the symbol of like God's presence with mm-hmm. the Israelites, right?
Yeah.
That here were these different artifacts of the covenant that were carried around, you know, that were carried around in this box.
Right.
So,
yeah. And that makes sense because as fallible human beings, like we need, I mean, you know, in elves too, even though they were the first children of Iluvatar, like they were still created beings.
Mm-hmm.
So like we need that physical, visible, you know, connection.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what Yavanna was, you know, providing through this carbon copy.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that's a great point. And that gets me thinking about the tragedy of what happens with Numenor and Numenor's descendants with the trees, because mm-hmm. with Nimloth, before I dive into it, do you remember what happens to Nimloth? It's kind of an important moment in the history of the Second Age.
Yeah.
It's there for most of the Second Age. For almost all 3,000 years of the Second Age, it's in Numenor. But then, do you remember?
Isn't it burned?
Yeah. So when Sauron finally comes to...
And the people burn it. Like, well, he basically convinces them to burn it.
So Sauron, Sauron, by, you know, late in the Second Age, he basically surrenders to Numenor and comes voluntarily as a prisoner to Numenor and then starts corrupting Numenorean society.
Right.
And by this time, of course... By the time he arrives, of course, he's already done a lot of work, and the Numenoreans have really turned away from Valinor and from friendship with the Valar and the Eldar and view them very much with suspicion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Sauron just, of course, exacerbates that, right? So he and his whole modus operandi is he just hates anything that causes friendship between Valar and any of the children of Iluvatar.
Right.
So he basically convinces the king, Ar-Pharazôn, to destroy Nimloth, right? And mm-hmm. and actually to use it in the temple that Sauron convinced him to erect to Morgoth, right?
Right. They use it as wood for the
human sacrifices,
yeah, for the sacrifices,
right?
Sacrifices, yes.
So the sacrifice really of the faithful, right? Mm-hmm. So the mm-hmm. party of Amandil. So it's Nimloth is, you know, it's tragically cut down after all that time of being the symbol of friendship between the elves of Tol Eressëa and Numenor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's interesting about that is we never hear anything about, like, you know, Galathelion or Celeborn being cut down by the elves of, you know, the Blessed Realm, right? Those apparently are still standing, you know, even into the Third Age. I think there may be even a reference to the light of Tol Eressëa, at the end of Lord of the Rings, as Frodo is passing into the west, but regardless, we never have any sense that they were cut down. But we have this continuing problem with the trees of Numenor and Numenor's descendants, and it would seem that like this is a reflection on the limitation of men, right? So with elves, of course, the elves of Tol Eressëa, where we can assume by the end of the Third Age, are the same elves that have been there since. Before the First Age,
right? Yeah.
And the same with the elves of Telperion,
mm-hmm.
or I'm sorry, of Tirion. And elves, because they're immortal, right? But mm-hmm. men, even the Numenoreans who live for a long time, are mortal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to pass on the traditions to people who weren't there, to their descendants who weren't there for, you know, the actual moments that proved, right, the friendship here. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. For them, this is just a symbol, right? For them, it doesn't have any of the significance that it had when it was first brought, like for Ar-Pharazôn, right?
Right. Yeah.
We'll just use him as an example. It's all, this is just ancient history. It's some myth from the past that doesn't even matter. It's probably just made up to control people, right?
Mm-hmm.
As far as he knows,
yeah.
Right? And anyway, we're not getting eternal life. We're not getting immortality out of it. They're holding back from us. So why should we bother with it? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you
it's
know,
not serving any functional purpose, like,
right?
Yeah,
right. So, yeah. So it's, even though it is this reminder, Nimloth is supposed to be this reminder. It's because it almost seems like it's a function of the limitation of men
mm-hmm.
with being mortal that they're going to eventually view it with suspicion, right? What's so important about this tree anyway?
Yeah.
What good is it doing? What function does it have?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. How is it helping me?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. Okay, so let's look at some of the a couple of passages from Akalabeth that speak of Nimloth. So First, we have this passage from earlier on in the Silmarillion. Greta, do you want to read this?
Sure. But the wise among them knew that this distant land was not indeed the blessed realm of Valinor, but was Avalone, the haven of the Eldar upon
Erisea,
easternmost of the Undying Lands. And thence at times the firstborn still would come sailing to Numenor in oarless boats as white birds flying from the sunset. And they brought to Numenor many gifts, birds of song and fragrant flowers and herbs of great virtue. And a seedling they brought of Celeborn, the white tree that grew in the midst of Erisea. And that was in its turn a seedling of Galathilion, the tree of Tuna, the image of Telperion that Yavanna gave to the Eldar in the Blessed Realm. And the tree grew and blossomed in the courts of the king and Armenelos. Nimloth it was named, and flowered in the evening, and the shadows of night it filled with its fragrance.
All right, yeah, so that's just, you know, that's just kind of a little passage that tells us about the coming of the of Nimloth to Numenor. I couldn't really find exactly when it came to Numenor. I mean, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't have been early on in the history of Numenor during the reign of Elros, the first king of Numenor, of course. But I couldn't find an exact date or even roundabout date that it came there. But I will just assume that because I know that that the elves of Tol Eressëa were coming to Numenor from the very beginning, mm-hmm. that it was probably there pretty early on, if not from the very beginning. An interesting note. So we talked about Celeborn being the name of both a significant elf and this tree, this, you know, the descendant of Galathilion and the father tree, I guess you could say, of Nimloth. But Nimloth was also the name of Deor's wife. And Deor was, of course, the son of Beren and Luthien. She was the mother of Elwing, the wife of Eärendil, and thus the grandmother of both Elrond and Elros. So Nimloth was also the name of, the name of the grandmother of both Elrond and Elros. So
interesting.
Yeah, I, it's interesting to think maybe that was, you know, maybe Elros named the tree after her, perhaps. We don't have necessarily any indication of that, but it's interesting to think that it might be, that might be the case. Yeah, so in just a little bit on the etymology of Nimloth. Nim is Sindarin for white, and loth is flower, so it means the white blossom, right? Nimloth is the white blossom.
Okay.
So there you go. All right. So when Sauron, like we said, when Sauron is taken captive to Numenor around 3262 of the Second Age, he encourages Ar-Pharazôn to destroy it and use it as to destroy Nimloth and use it as kindling for the temple to Melkor. And it's then that Isildur saves a fruit of Nimloth before it can be burned. So another important passage. We'll go ahead and read this passage from Akalabeth. And Sauron urged the king to cut down the white tree, Nimloth the Fair, that grew in his courts, for it was a memorial of the Eldar and of the light of Valinor. At the first, the king would not assent to this, since he believed that the fortunes of his house were bound up with the tree, as was forespoken by Tar Palantir. Thus, in his folly, he who now hated the Eldar and the Valar vainly clung to the shadow of the old allegiance of Numenor. But when Amandil heard rumor of the evil purpose of Sauron, he was grieved to the heart, knowing that in the end Sauron would surely have his will. Then he spoke to Elendil and the sons of Elendil, recalling the tale of the trees of Valinor. And Isildur said no word, but went out by night and did a deed for which he was afterwards renowned. For he passed alone in disguise to Armenelos and to the courts of the king, which were now forbidden to the faithful. And he came to the place of the tree, which was forbidden to all by the orders of Sauron, and the tree was watched day and night by guards in his service. At that time Nimloth was dark and bore no bloom, for it was late in the autumn, and its winter was nigh. And Isildur passed through the guards and took from the tree a fruit that hung upon it, and turned to go. But the guard was aroused, and he was assailed, and fought his way out, receiving many wounds. And he escaped, and because he was disguised, it was not discovered who had laid hands on the tree. But Isildur came at last hardly back to Romena and delivered the fruit to the hands of Amandil, ere his strength failed him. Then the fruit was planted in secret, and it was blessed by Amandil. And a shoot arose from it and sprouted in the spring. But when its first leaf opened, then Isildur, who had lain long and come near to death, arose and was troubled no more by his wounds. None too soon was this done, for after the assault the king yielded to Sauron and felled the white tree, and turned then wholly away from the allegiance of his fathers. But Sauron caused to be built upon the hill in the midst of the city of the Numenoreans, Armenelos the Golden, a mighty temple. And it was in the form... We'll go ahead and stop there, but that's our, that's the passage of Isildur's taking of the fruit from the, mm-hmm. From Nimloth, and thus preserving at least the heritage of the White Tree, right? For the, for the future descendants of Numenor, right? Yeah. So Nimloth is chopped down, used as kindling for the temple to Melkor, but Isildur, through a brave act, saves this fruit.
And right? What's interesting to me is, that what is it that encourages Isildur to go out and do this courageous act? It's the fact that the tradition, like the story mm-hmm. of the two trees of Valinor, was told to him.
Right, yeah.
By
yeah.
the king, right?
Yeah.
Or not the king, by...
Amandil. Yeah.
And, that just reminds me of what we were talking about earlier, right? About how it's incumbent on us mortals to pass down,
mm-hmm.
the traditions that hold value in our society. Because if Isildur didn't know, everybody else would just be like, oh, it's just a stupid old tree. Like, who cares? Yeah.
And it's interesting to was this the first time Isildur had heard that
story? It kind of sounds like it, doesn't it?
Or had he heard it before and he just needed a reminding of it? Amandil kind of convinced him to do it by telling the story. Because you'd think, that would be part of Numenorean society, to know this lore of the two trees of Valinor, right?
Right.
Like, how did our people come to this land? Well, they came to this land because they aided the elves of Middle-earth and the Valar, the lords of the West, and the struggle against Morgoth in the First Age. Well, what was that struggle all about? Well, it was about these jewels that contained a holy light that was stolen from Valinor by the Dark Lord mm-hmm. Morgoth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, mm-hmm. tell me more about those jewels. Well, they contained the light of the two trees of Valinor. You think right. it's not too far back to get that kind of mm-hmm. that kind of knowledge.
No.
Especially for somebody that's apparently of such high status as, somebody like Isildur would have been, right?
Right, right,
but
yeah.
Also, what's cool about this is, Isildur always gets a bad rap,
right? He does, I know.
Because it's like, good job, dude, you could have destroyed the ring and you had to keep it, and mm-hmm. so, then you caused, another age of Sauron, right? Just by the selfishness with the one ring. But it's like, actually, let's give Isildur some credit. First of all, he was immortal, and so... He didn't really know what he was coming up against with the One Ring, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he did this pretty awesome thing where he basically almost died trying to save a fruit of Nimloth, mm-hmm. right? And then he also is the one who actually defeats Sauron in the first place, right? Even though he keeps the One Ring stupidly and is eventually dies because of it, he actually did defeat, was the one that defeated Sauron at the last alliance of men and elves.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, need to remember that.
So, it's actually, it's for as much as Isildur kind of gets the nice going, kind of rap, he apparently was a pretty heroic and great Numenorean. So
he really was. Yeah, he really was. And it's interesting too that he's basically healed
mm-hmm.
by the flowering or the sprouting.
Mm-hmm.
Right, of the fruit that's planted.
Yeah.
So it clearly has some, even though it has no light of its own.
Yeah.
It clearly has some healing, spiritual power.
It has some spiritual property, yeah. Right? Yeah. Some spirit. The tree is more than just a mere symbol. It's got some right. kind of sacramental resonance or something like that,
yes,
right?
Totally.
Spiritual resonance. So, and I think this is, just a side thought. This is in keeping with what would have been Tolkien's view of sacraments, right? That that, you know, and as Catholics, we hold a similar view where we think, like, you know, yes, a sacrament is a symbol, but it's a symbol. It's more than a mere symbol. A mere symbol, like, shows something, but it doesn't have any power of itself to affect that thing, to affect what it symbolizes, right?
Right.
A stop sign is a symbol that means stop, but it can't make you stop, right? However, a sacrament has the power to affect the thing that it symbolizes, right?
Right. Yep. So it's an efficacious symbol.
Right, it's an efficacious symbol.
Yes.
Nice word.
Thanks.
So, yeah, so let's continue in the history here. So the next tree, we'll call the from here on, the trees don't have any names, at least not that I was able to find. But there's basically four trees during the Third Age. There's four descendants of Nimloth during the Third Age.
And they all come from...
from Nimloth, right?
From the fruit that is saved by Isildur.
Isildur, yeah. So I think we'll abbreviate this with just the WTG, since they don't have any other names, but the White Tree of Gondor, right? Okay. The WTG, the Wittig. So the Wittig one... Wittig 1 is the seedling of Nimloth, which is brought back to Middle-earth on Isildur's ship, where he plants it in Minas Ithil, right?
And that would have been when they escaped Numenor just prior to its destruction.
Its destruction, that's right.
Yeah.
However, Sauron attacks Minas Ithil in Second Age 3429, captures Minas Ithil, and burns the White Tree.
He's got a real thing against these White Trees.
He does. And it's interesting, I think... within that, we can discover something about the meaning of the White Tree again, right? Because it's this powerful symbol of the mm-hmm. connection between the Numenoreans and the Elves, right? And their friendship, right? The struggle they had against Morgoth. So it symbolizes, right, Morgoth's downfall, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really does, right?
Yeah. I mean, clearly, if Sauron hates it so much, it clearly serves some great purpose.
Yes.
That maybe even that the Numenoreans and all them aren't even aware of, mm-hmm. right? But that's a tip off, right? If some evil being hates something a lot, like, take notice, because that means there's actually something real important.
Absolutely.
About it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the hatred of an enemy for something tells you something about that thing.
It does.
Right?
Yeah. And it often means that there's a lot of good in it.
Yeah.
If evil hates it so much.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, I would say it applies also in the reverse, you know, to if there's some symbol of, you know, that's something that symbolizes something that's evil, and somebody who you think of as good hates it so much, is like, why do they hate it so much? Right.
Exactly. Yep.
Enmity tells you something about, mm-hmm. about, both the thing that has
value.
The enmity and the thing that is, and the object of the enmity.
Right. Yes.
So this White Tree of Gondor, the first White Tree of Gondor, doesn't last very long. It's in Minas Ithil, which of course is the, fittingly is the, Tower of the Moon, right? The City of the Moon, mm-hmm. on that becomes Minas Morgul after Sauron takes it. Which is, again, is fitting because this is, again, we're talking about a tree that's in the image of the Silver Tree, right, of Telperion. So Isildur escapes with the seedling, and the seedling of the...
So he again escapes with the seedling.
Yes, he does, right?
Good for him.
So the White Tree of Gondor 2... the seedling of White Tree of Gondor 1, White Tree of Gondor 2, is planted in Minas Anor by Isildur in Third Age 2, in memory of his brother Anarion, who was slain in the last alliance of men and elves. It lasts until Third Age 1636, so much longer than the mm-hmm. first tree did,
mm-hmm.
first White Tree of Gondor, when the Great Plague hits Gondor. So it seems to indicate that the plague must have killed the second White Tree, this mm-hmm. Great Plague.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never explicitly made clear that that's what killed it, right? It's odd to me that a plague, not that I know anything about this really, but it's odd to me that a plague that kills people mm-hmm. would also kill a tree.
Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, especially when you think about diseases that affect trees. Those don't affect humans.
Yeah. Now, of course, Tolkien also wasn't a you know, infectious disease expert.
No, he was not.
But
and
so,
neither are we.
So again, this great plague, we haven't, this was a new thing to me. This great plague was a new thing to me when we did the history of the Third Age, and I haven't looked much into it. So I suppose the Great Plague could have been some kind of spiritual plague, right? Like that had its root in Sauron. In fact, let's just assume that it probably had something to do with Sauron shenanigans, right?
Yeah.
So, because it does coincide with the shadow deepening in Mirkwood and the reappearance of evil things there. So it's possible that it was some kind of, you know, plague devised by Sauron that was able to both, you know, kill men and kill.
Right. Some kind of supernatural plague.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So
that's the second tree is killed by the plague.
Yeah. And it's, but here's the other question I had. Does it die because of the death of the king from the plague, right? So Telimnar means silver flame. So was it like, you know, was there a connection between Telimnar being the silver flame, the flame of life, the soul, right? And the tree, you know, that's what's not entirely clear.
Good food for thought.
Yeah. So the third one, the White Tree of Gondor, number 3, is planted in Minas Tirith by King Tarandor in Third Age 1640. So just 4 years after the death of the second tree.
So how did they get a third tree from the second tree?
So let's see here. So a third sapling was planted in Third Age 1640 by King Tarandor and died in Third Age 2872. I don't have the exact reference to whether it was directly a seed. I assume it was just a seedling of the second one. I think that's probably a safe assumption, right? It
wasn't they learned their lesson.
It wasn't like it was
just
destroyed at the last second. It was, you know,
they had time to kind of.
Yeah. Maybe they were like, maybe we need to start having some seedlings of the white tree.
Yeah.
You know,
that's smart.
Yeah. Just in case we run into problems.
Yeah.
Just in case Sauron's up to his
old
shenanigans.
Or the third one, rather, was a direct descendant of the second.
I would assume they all are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's no indication that they weren't, right? Yeah. So I think Tolkien would tell us somewhere if it wasn't a direct descendant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he did with Telperion and Galathilion.
Right.
Yeah. So that one lasts, the third tree lasts for about 1,200 years until 2872 with the death of the ruling steward, Belekthor II. And it's not clear why the white tree, the third white tree, dies.
That's the one that's left standing.
But that's the one that's left standing that we see in Lord of the Rings, in the Courts of the King, when Pippin goes in to meet with Denethor, right?
Mm-hmm.
He sees this dead white tree.
It's interesting that they left this tree standing.
Mm-hmm.
Like I understand why they did, but you just think about, like, it's a dead tree.
Mm-hmm.
That in and of itself, like, that's really depressing. To have a dead tree, like, in the center of a courtyard.
Yeah.
And you think about Denethor's, you know, just, like, his state of mind, right? Mm-hmm. When we meet him in Lord of the Rings. You can't help but think those two things are connected, right? If you see something dead up in your courtyard, like, that's gonna have an effect on just people's moods. And, like, if you're forced to walk by a dead tree...
Yeah.
Every day. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, I understand why they did, because it was an important symbol and everything. But it's almost like they should have cut it down and put, like, a memorial or something instead.
Made, like, a fake white tree?
Like a fake white tree, or just, like, a, like, maybe carved a, you know, made a statue of it or something. Or had someone paint a picture of it and hang it in the halls of the king. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it almost seems like it's... It's more of a having this dead tree there is a reminder of, like, past glory and, like, we'll never be that great again.
Right. Exactly.
I think maybe it was they were leaving it there intended as a symbol of future hope, you know, that one day it would again blossom, but it definitely doesn't have that feeling. Let me read this passage from Lord of the Rings where Pippin sees it. The guards of the gate were robed in black, and their helms were of strange shape, high-crowned, with long cheek guards close-fitting to the face, and above the cheek guards were set the white wings of seabirds. But the helms gleamed with a flame of silver, for they were indeed wrought of mithril, heirlooms from the glory of old days. Upon the black surcoats were embroidered in white white, a tree blossoming like snow beneath a silver crown and many pointed stars. This was the livery of the heirs of Elendil, and none wore it now in all Gondor save the guards of the citadel before the court of the fountain where the white tree once had grown. Already it seemed that word of their coming had gone before them, and at once they were admitted silently and without question. Quickly Gandalf strode across the white-paved court. A sweet fountain played there in the morning sun, and a sward of bright green lay about it. But in the midst, drooping over the pool, stood a dead tree, and the falling drops dripped sadly from its barren and broken branches back into the clear water. Pippin glanced at it as he hurried after Gandalf. It looked mournful, he thought, and he wondered why the dead tree was left in this place where everything else was well tended. Seven stars and seven stones and one white tree. The words that Gandalf had murmured came back into his mind, and then he found himself at the doors of the great hall beneath the gleaming tower, and behind the wizard he passed the tall, silent door wardens and entered the cool, echoing shadows of the House of Stone. So, yeah, Pippin seems to have the same thought as you, Greta.
I was gonna say, Pippin is a little depressed by it, too.
Yeah.
It just probably seemed very out of place.
Right.
Too.
Yeah, so that is the, you know, that is the tree. This third tree is the one that we see here. And it's standing, you know, dead from 2872 until 3019.
And then they actually bury it. Like they put it in the tombs of the kings.
That's right. So
why didn't they just do that sooner? I don't know. I just can't help but think that it would have like really helped those people's outlook on life.
I can see how some would have wanted that, but I can also see how some would have resisted that and said like, no, this is, even though it's dead, it's still a symbol of, you know, future hope. It's a symbol of our connection to Numenor of old. It's a symbol of our connection to the Blessed Realm, all of these things.
I can see that. I'm thinking like, even if they'd like wrapped it in fairy lights or something, like they, I know they didn't have fairy lights back then, but you know, like if they had just done something to it to make it not look so depressing. You know?
Yeah.
Like maybe just, I don't know, put some fake leaves on it or something.
Well, so they didn't, and that brings us to 2019.
I know, I need to get over it, don't I?
you make a good point, but White Tree of Gondor number 4. All right, so this is the White Tree of Gondor number 4 is found by Aragorn in the mountains near Minas Tirith. And here is the account of that finding from Lord of the Rings. You want to go and read it?
Sure. There came a day when Gandalf could not be found, and the companions wondered what was going forward. But Gandalf took Aragorn out from the city by night, and he brought him to the southern feet of Mount Mindulian. And there they found a path made in ages past that few now dared to tread. For it led up onto the mountain, to a high hollow, where only the kings had been wont to go. And they went up by steep ways until they came to a high field below the snows that clad the lofty peaks, and it looked down over the precipice that stood behind the city. And standing there they surveyed the lands, for the morning was come. And they saw the towers of the city far below them like white pencils touched by the sunlight. And all the vale of Anduin was like a garden, and the mountains of shadow were veiled in a golden mist. Upon the one side their sight reached to the gray Amin Muil, and the glint
Amin Will,
and the glint of Rauros was like a star twinkling far off. And upon the other side they saw the river like a ribbon laid down to Pelargir, and beyond that was a light on the hem of the sky that spoke of the sea. And Gandalf said, "This is your realm, and the heart of the greater realm that shall be. The third age of the world is ended, and the new age is begun, and it is your task to order its beginning and to preserve what may be preserved. For though much has been saved, much must now pass away, and the power of the three rings also is ended. And all the lands that you see, and those that lie round about them, shall be dwellings of men. For the time comes of the dominion of men, and the elder kindred shall fade or depart." "I know it well, dear friend," said Aragorn, "but I would still have your counsel." "Not for long now," said Gandalf. "The third age was my age. I was the enemy of Sauron, and my work is finished. I shall go soon. The burden must lie now upon you and your kindred." "But I shall die," said Aragorn, for I'm a mortal man, and though being what I am, and of the race of the West unmingled, I shall have life far longer than other men, yet that is but a little while. And when those who are now in the wombs of women are born and have grown old, I too shall grow old. And who then shall govern Gondor and those who look to this city as to their queen? If my desire be not granted, the tree in the court of the fountain is still withered and barren. When shall I see a sign that it will ever be otherwise? Turn your face from the green world and look where all seems barren and cold, said Gandalf. Then Aragorn turned, and there was a stony slope behind him running down from the skirts of the snow, and as he looked, he was aware that alone there in the waste a growing thing stood, and he climbed to it and saw that out of the very edge of the snow there sprang a sapling tree no more than 3 foot high. Already it had put forth young leaves, long and shapely, dark above and silver beneath, and upon its slender crown it bore one small cluster of flowers whose white petals shone like the sunlit snow. Then Aragorn cried, I can't pronounce that.
Yay, UTVN, yes. I'll continue.
Okay.
I have found it. Lo, here is a scion of the eldest of trees. But how comes it here? For it is not itself yet 7 years old. And Gandalf coming looked at it and said, Verily, this is a sapling of the line of Nimloth the Fair. And that was a seedling of Galathelion, and that a fruit of Telperion of many names, eldest of trees. Who shall say how it comes here in the appointed hour? But this is an ancient hallow, and ere the kings failed or the tree withered in the court, a fruit must have been set here. For it is said that, though the fruit of the tree comes seldom to ripeness, yet the life within may then lie sleeping through many long years, and none can foretell the time in which it will awake. Remember this, for if ever a fruit ripens, it should be planted, lest the line die out of the world. Here it has lain hidden on the mountain, even as the race of Elendil lay hidden in the wastes of the north. Yet the line of Nimloth is older far than your line, King Elessar. Then Aragorn laid his hand gently to the sapling, and lo, it seemed to hold only lightly to the earth, and it was removed without hurt, and Aragorn bore it back to the citadel. Then the withered tree was uprooted, but with reverence, and they did not burn it, but laid it to rest in the silence of Rath Dinan. And Aragorn planted the new tree in the court by the fountain, and swiftly and gladly it began to grow, and when the month of June entered in, it was laden with blossom. The sign has been given, said Aragorn, and the day is not far off. And he set watchmen upon the walls. And so, you know, that's what follows from there is the wedding of Arwen and of
Aragorn.
Aragorn, yeah.
Yep.
So,
so strange to me that they just happened to be the seedling like up in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it seems like whoever put it there was trying to hide it. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't want it easily found for obvious reasons.
Right. Well, like you said, I think probably they you know, the Numenoreans and their descendants learned after all of these times that maybe they should have some backups. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can even kind of think of Aragorn as being like, you know, they thought the line of kings, right, was gone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a hidden. You know, the hidden heir, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
In a way, you know, this tree represents him, right? This little sapling represents him. And then its blossoming represents, you know, again, like the blossoming and the renewal of the friendship between men and elves, right?
Mm-hmm. With
the
marriage. Has been defeated.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
With the marriage. And then, and so I think that's why he says the time is, basically the time is now right. And then he and Arwen get married, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, so that's the fourth white tree. So, four white trees of Gondor after Nimloth the Fair, right? And then we have our other trees. Now, I did find the very confusing line in there that says that Galathelion was a fruit of Telperion. And so this seems to be one of those, you know, maybe a slightly controversial point of what exactly does he mean there, because all of the other references I've found don't seem to indicate that it was a direct descendant of Telperion, right?
Yeah.
That the only fruit we have of Telperion is, or that we have the flower of Telperion, right? With the, you know, with the moon. So maybe by fruit, he just means kind of like the fruit of like Yavanna's trying to make something in the image of Telperion, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, as always with our episodes with this lore, if you have other information which we skipped or if you think we got something wrong, we're always always up for hearing you out and getting it right.
For sure. So. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the big picture on the white trees of Gondor and how we got them, right? So Galathelion, you know, Telperion, Galathelion, Celeborn, Nimloth, and then the four white trees, right?
Mm-hmm.
The four white trees of Gondor.
Yep.
So
yep.
There you go.
And as far as we know, the white tree of Gondor is still like lasted for a long time.
Yeah, well, we don't know.
We don't know any different.
Much into the fourth age what happened,
right,
but
right.
Yeah, but here in terms of the story, it stands as kind of that renewal of that you know, ancient friendship, mm-hmm. right? That ancient friendship between Numenor and the elves and Valinor.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so it is an image of Telperion, the silver tree of Valinor. It is a symbol of the favor and kinship of the elves who love Telperion dearly. It is also a symbol of the elvish friendship to the Dunedain and a symbol of fraternity and a symbol of the Blessed Realm. And I would even argue that it is a symbol of Lúthien the Fair, and perhaps this is why Sauron hates it with such a passion. Not only is it a symbol of Valinorian hope, a symbol of friendship between men and elves, and a reminder of their kinship as children of Iluvatar, but it alludes to the first one who bested him, mm-hmm. right? So going back to chapter 19 mm-hmm. of the Silmarillion, the story of Beren and Lúthien, right? It's Lúthien who really, you know, kick Sauron's butt for the first time,
right?
When she's, you know, when she sings and you know, breaks open the dungeon that Beren and it's not Fingolfin, but Finrod, Felagund, are trapped
right.
in that dungeon, and mm-hmm. she sings and like basically all the prisoners come forth, and then she and Huon do like face to face battle with Sauron, and
right.
and Sauron goes running off.
Yep.
Like a little baby. So yeah, I think his, you know, there's something of his hatred for it. It's just that it's a reminder of all these, you know, defeats by, mm-hmm. and Lúthien herself, of course, being something of a symbol of, you know, of the friendship between, the Maiar, between the Ainur and between Valinor and the elves, being a descendant of Melian, the Maia, and mm-hmm. And of her father,
yeah,
Thingol. Thank you. And then marrying, of course, Beren, right?
Right.
Who was a man?
A man, right? So. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I like that.
So it's just a rich symbol, you know. It's a very
yeah.
rich symbol and a very potent symbol and a very functional symbol, mm-hmm. as it turns out.
As it turns out,
and it
yep.
apparently there's some kind of spiritual property that even goes with the white tree, even though it doesn't have that holy light of Telperion necessarily. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, it's cool. And it's beautiful. Like I love mm-hmm. all the artwork that's been done in tribute. You know, I've seen lots of different artwork from different artists depicting the white tree, and it's
yeah.
just always so pretty.
Most def.
Yeah.
So that, my friends, is the story of the White Tree of Gondor, a primer on its role and significance in the history of Middle-earth.
Boom. You heard it here first.
All right. Correspondence time.
Woo-woo.
So, as always, we'd love to hear from all of you, TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, mm-hmm. through the website, Facebook, Twitter, etc. This week, we've got a couple of correspondences to discuss. The first is a short but sweet note from Rob G., sent on September 23rd. And by the way, we don't always get to things in chronological order as we receive them. Sometimes we have to put things off because they deserve a longer response and we just don't have time to get to it on a particular week. But Rob says, I found your website through the podcast on Spotify. I'm only 5 episodes in, but it has been enjoyable thus far. May the road always rise to meet you.
Oh, how nice. Yeah.
So
glad you found us, Rob.
Absolutely. Thanks for sending us a note there, Rob, mm-hmm. and hope your journey continues to be a good one.
Yeah, enjoyable.
Absolutely.
So keep listening.
Absolutely. Our next email comes from, let's see, I'm going to skip around a little bit here so we can spend a little more time on some of the longer ones. So let's jump to a comment that Darth Vegan left on our YouTube for
Darth Vegan
on our YouTube for episode 210. Darth Vegan said, I'd be more tempted to watch it on YouTube instead of listening to the podcast if there was video of John and Greta recording it. And maybe occasionally some Tolkien art splashed in. So I wanted to highlight this, and thanks for your note, Darth Vegan. I wanted to highlight this because I love the idea of doing a, at least for some episodes, and maybe in the future, all episodes, a live, like live streaming our recording of this podcast, right? I know that some people really enjoy that, and I can see really enjoying that. Here's the thing, though. That, like, we do our production for the podcast off, you know, offline, and we can go back and record, and it just in the process of going live, as I think about it, for us to be able to do these things live, for me right now feels like it would be a lot more involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely takes some more upfront planning, and so all that is to say, I love this idea. And I could see us transitioning into this, but it's really up to you guys if we ever move to that level of doing this, because and I don't say this like lightly, but the more patronage we have, right, the more financial incentive we have to move in that direction, you know, the more it's possible for that to become a reality. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
It really is just purely a function of, you know, how much we're able to bring in, because right now, in terms of both of our times, right, the podcast tends to compete with
a lot of other things,
with our jobby jobs, right?
Yeah.
And even just with and so our jobby jobs compete with our family time, right?
Mm.
Time with the kids and everything. So it's not really a question of taking time away from the kids. It's more a question of not having to do so much with jobby jobs. And so I'm just putting a plug out there for what Darth Vegan said. I'd love to be able to do that. And if you listening to this right now, whoever you are, would love to be able to like watch us live stream and like interact with us during the podcast while we're recording it.
We did that once.
We've done it a few times. And I'm not saying we won't ever do it. We're not going to do it like again anytime soon. I think I've been wanting to maybe try some of that a little bit more. But to make it really become a reality, something we regularly do, we'd have to have a significant
a
boost in our patronage.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And if you end up signing up to be a patron because of that, make sure we know that like that's what you want to see, right? That's what you'd really love to see. So, yeah, just, you know, if there's more people out there that feel like Darth Vegan, let us know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Do.
All right. Thanks, Darth.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's see. Next up is, let's pick a shorter one. All right. We got Jennifer with a comment on episode 210. Of course, 210 was the one from last week, The Fate of the Fellowship. Jennifer says, Master Samwise and Rose had 14 children. Their eldest son, Frodo, changed his surname to Gardner in honor of his father, and I believe he also was a gardener. They also named some of their other children after Mary, Pippin, and yes, Sam and Rosie Lass. Yeah. So, Jennifer dropping some knowledge on the Gamgee family.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know they had 14.
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay. Very cool.
Absolutely.
I like to know that kind of stuff. I wonder where would one find that knowledge?
I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's in, I want to say it's actually mentioned in Lord of the, in, no.
I don't mean
so it wasn't in their
spot.
Timeline.
I was just wondering.
Oh, you know what it is? It's probably in the,
appendix.
It's probably in the, family tree, right? So
let's
go to the family tree. I got it right here.
Yeah.
I was going to quote something for another correspondence from Lord of the Rings. So let's see if we can find the family tree of the, Gamgees here.
I forgot that there were family trees in the back of the
here we go.
Lord of the Rings books.
And let me see if I can lock my screen so I can turn it sideways here. All right. Aspect lock. There we go. All right. So here we go. We got Sam and Rose. We got Eleanor, Frodo, Rose, Mary, Pippin, Goldilocks, Hamfast, Daisy, Primrose, Bilbo, Ruby, Robin, and Tolman. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So I see 13.
Hmm.
I may be counting wrong. I see 13 on this family tree, but maybe I'm missing something. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Yeah.
Jennifer, either I'm counting wrong or you are. So I'm inclined to think it's me. So let me know if I'm.
That's the only
wrong
difference
on
of one. I mean, when you have like that many kids, what's one more or one less? I mean, really.
Boy, that would be a great thing to tell the 14th kid.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Honestly, I felt like going from 2 to 3 was the hardest. Yeah. After that, it's like, what's one more?
Right.
But it's cool that they named one Bilbo.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. So, well, thanks for the note.
Yeah. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for the note, Jennifer. Our next piece of correspondence here is we'll go with Paige. Paige sent a very nice note on the 25th of September here. Paige says, "Hi, John. Hi, Greta. Paige here. Thought I would drop a line. I'm moving to Norway to begin graduate school. It's a 2-year program, so this week has been filled with lots of goodbyes as I set off on this new journey."
Ooh, that's exciting.
That is very exciting. She says, "I listened to Chapter 11 in Fellowship on the plane from Denver to Boston and your corresponding podcast episode while waiting in the Boston airport for my next flight." Very cool. She says, "I can't tell you how relieved I was and how heartened I felt when I heard both John and Frodo talk about the hateful road west, longing to be back in the Shire, living a normal life instead of out on adventure. I felt like I was supposed to be excited, not homesick. But hearing your insight and remembering tales of old was chicken soup for my soul."
Aww.
"I plan to continue listening abroad, and I'm grateful I have so much of the Tolkien road left to wander. Thanks again for all that you do."
Oh, that's so nice.
I know. From way back in episode 36.
Wow.
Yeah, going back in time for us there.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that cool? Like, I feel like that's maybe not appreciated enough aspect of good literature is how it can really, like, it can help us through all kinds of things in life.
Absolutely.
You know, it can be an encouragement, it can be a balm, it can be, you know, it can just be like, if you're going through something rough and you're reading a book about someone else that's going through something rough, like, it can be like, even those people aren't real,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, they do feel like friends that have come along to walk by you and support you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love that Paige shared that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's how the Lord of the Rings, you know, feels for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. I was curious because it has been such a long time since we recorded that episode. So I went back and I used my nice Kindle version of Lord of the Rings to search for the word hateful. And I found the passage she was referring to. And it's when I think, so Frodo and Strider are talking and they're on the road. And so this is from the chapter, A Knife in the Dark, I believe. So it's right before Frodo gets, stabbed on Weathertop. But they're on, you know, they're on their road to Rivendell. And, it says this: "They stood for a while silent on the hilltop," as in they being Frodo and Strider, "near its southward edge. In that lonely place, Frodo, for the first time, fully realized his homelessness and danger. He wished bitterly that his fortune had left him in the quiet and beloved Shire. He stared down at the hateful road leading back westward to his home. Suddenly, he was aware that two black specks were moving slowly along it, going westward. And looking again, he saw that three others were creeping eastward to meet them. He gave a cry and clutched Strider's arm." So, of course, you know, those are the Nazgul,
mm-hmm.
the Black Riders. But that the road, the westward road, right? The hateful road.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully, Paige, you're not, going into the arms of, journeying into the
not
arms
doomed.
Of extreme danger like Frodo is. But I can kind of think of where I must have been in that, in that particular episode in terms of my own headspace and understanding Frodo's sense of like, you know, yes, there's adventure and there's like, you know, terrifying adventure to be heading into. And also just the adventure of like that you're kind of bound to, right? That you feel like you're fated to, and you don't want to leave the things behind. You wish you were back with the things behind, but you feel a burden or a call to journey on this road into the unknown.
Right.
And maybe even into danger. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Paige, just wanted to say thanks for the really cool note.
Yeah. Yeah. And we wish you the best on your studies.
Graduate studies.
Time in Norway.
Yeah.
That'll be
Sounds like a pretty cool place to be doing. I would love to visit Norway, mm-hmm. all the Scandinavian countries mm-hmm. one of these days.
Yeah. You'd have to learn to like fish, though.
Well, I didn't say I'd want to like live there. I'm just saying I'm saying
even just to, you know, survive while you're there, you're going to have to eat fish.
Okay.
Just saying.
You heard it from Greta, people.
Mm-hmm.
Greta speaking on behalf
Paige
of...
I hope Paige likes fish.
Greta speaking on behalf of the Norwegian on the Scandinavian Tourist Bureau.
That's right.
So...
why not? I'm super fresh, right?
You've lost me at this point.
Anyway, okay.
All right.
Well, safe journey, Paige.
Safe journey, Paige.
Yes.
Absolutely. All right. And our last note for this week is a longer one from our friend, David. David over at the Card Talk podcast. Fellow podcaster, I should say. So David says, "Hi, John and Greta. Man, I've been really into your history of the Third Age. I have a bunch to say, and I just had to send you an email about it all." He says, just a couple... And by the way, this is actually for episode 209. He sent a correction email later on and said, I meant for 209, about the seventh part of the history of the Third Age. So he says, the once-a-week format is great. I love the continuous content. And then he says... big thanks for the shout out on episode 200. It was great to hear that you had a great time on our show. Yes, of course we did. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, as I think mentioned to you, David, I'd love to see about doing teaming up again and doing more on the teaching us the Lord of the Rings card game. He says, now specifically episode 209 has me particularly excited because of the game. Almost all of the people, places, and adventures that you mentioned in this episode are contained within the game somehow. And have you both described the timeline allows a more rich and deep appreciation for the game and the developers. But also, and maybe more importantly, it allows me to see just how rich and detailed the world of Tolkien is. Yes, the game takes some liberties. Of course it does, because it is, after all, a game. But to see how these events and places come alive through the card game is amazing. The more I listen to your podcast, the more I believe that if Tolkien were alive, he would absolutely love the game and its development of his world. You know, I really hope so. I really hope that that Tolkien... would appreciate like when good work is done to further develop the stories that he created. And I feel like,
mm-hmm.
I feel like if you read the Waldman letter, which we referred to frequently, he had kind of this mindset. Of course he had no idea what a video game was. He died in 19 or even probably a card game, right? Was of this nature, right?
Of this type. Yeah. Like, right? The role playing,
I mean,
type of thing.
I'm sure he knew what card games were, but just like, card games, video games,
mm-hmm.
all he really knew was like these like really lame attempts at adapting his books for movies and TV, which, you know, I have to think that he would probably appreciate Jackson's work to some degree. I'm sure he'd have his criticisms,
mm-hmm.
But I have to think he'd appreciate some of, you know, it in some aspects. And I think the little experience I have with the card game, David, you know, I'm very impressed by the knowledge of the lore, and I feel like I learned things. I'm going to actually shift slightly here and say that I've been playing more of the Lord of the Rings Online, which I've actually been, and, you know, some people recommended I give it a shot. And I've actually been playing that a little bit,
mm-hmm.
right? Just mm-hmm. to try and get into it. And I have to say, like, I'm very impressed by it. Like, it really, and I feel like they do a really good job with the lore. You know, you kind of think they're not just making everything up. I mean, again, like, they have to take some liberties here and there, but they really do try to keep it true to, you know, to the lore that Tolkien himself created. And in fact, the game, as I've played it, Lord of the Rings Online, it starts in, I think it's Arket, A-R-C-H-E-T. And I was just looking, and as I was doing research to find that passage for Paige's correspondence from Lord of the Rings, I saw the names of the two towns that I didn't even realize were actually Tolkien had created. So Arket or Archet, I'm not sure which one it is, and Combe, right?
Oh.
So these are two actual towns that are mentioned in Lord of the Rings just in passing. And so that's the place you start in Lord of the Rings Online. And, so that was pretty cool.
That was very cool.
And so this, David, is why I'm hoping that Greta and I can find the time to learn more about the card game too, because I think it could be a really fun way to interact around, you know, around this lore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's the value of these card games and these, you know, or one of the key points of value of the card games and the lore or in the video games for Lord of the Rings fans.
Yeah. Because
they can be done well and they can actually immerse you more into Tolkien's world.
Right.
In a successful way.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I totally agree.
He goes on to say, lastly, I wanted to weigh in on the idea of free will that Marilyn the librarian talks about and you and Greta discussed at the end of the episode 209. Keep in mind, I'm not a philosopher and I'm just a, I won't read your name, David, or your age, David, but, and I'm just a chem teacher with a lifetime of experience. But my take on free will isn't that all possibilities are always available to people, but that people always have the option to choose an available option without interference from a higher power. To use your example from the pod, Alorin was given the choice by Manwë to go to Middle Earth or not. Sure, he was selected, but he could have said no. It's free will to choose. Your example of the person without the ability to walk isn't given the choice to walk, but is given the choice on how to deal with the disability. So I've always thought that the list of choices are outlined by a higher power, but you, the individual, have the ultimate choice which choice to make.
Mm-hmm.
Put another way, when I make a sandwich, I don't have the option of making every possible sandwich that exists in the world. I have the option on making PB&J or turkey because that's what's in my house, or I can go to the store and buy different sandwich constructing materials, or maybe go to Subway and buy a sub sandwich. But making me hungry now.
Yeah, I know, right?
But I don't have the option of making a whale meat sandwich on naan with a remoulade sauce. It's just not an option. Free will says you can, without interference from God, or in the case of Lord of the Rings, Manwë or Eru, choose one of the options. But the options you have all come from God. Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think this is kind of what I was trying to get at is in that discussion is, you know, we're not like absolutely. We're not free, and no created being is free in an absolute sense, right? We're constrained by our context, right? The context in which we find ourselves.
Yes.
And I think that's what you're saying, David, and I would agree with that, mm-hmm. right? That
yeah, I would too.
We've got a limited set of choices at the end of the day, but nevertheless, we still have that ability to choose between two things. And I think it's particularly important in the case of moral questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is like where the question of Gandalf choosing, right? His choice, right? It takes a moral decision. Moral might not even be the best word in that case because it's more of a, it is moral in some sense because he's got to choose to obey Manwë, or even maybe not obey, but to like kind of sacrifice his own desires to maybe stay put and listen to a wiser being than himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to kind of have some faith in that choice that the wiser being is making, to then step out and continue down that path. So, anyway,
I mean, I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think that's, I think we're all on the same page here.
Yeah. Whenever free will is such a loaded concept at the end of the day, it's one of these things that you've really got to take care to define your terms and constrain kind of what you're talking about in order to have a productive conversation.
Absolutely.
Right, about it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, good thoughts, David. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with the things you said there, certainly. Lastly, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think it was Jefferson who said that his God would love people that choose him instead of blindly dictating that they must follow him. So, and, you know, I don't know if Jefferson said that. I assume you mean Thomas Jefferson. I think that's an interesting quote from Thomas Jefferson, and I won't go into all of the reasons why on that one, but it is an interesting quote, and he certainly had some interesting views on these subjects. So
yeah, it's a loaded topic.
Absolutely. I feel like I want to go and talk more about it, but I'm like, I don't really have time to get super far into it.
Yeah, because like once you pass the point of no return, like it's all over.
Or else this podcast is going to get an hour longer.
Right.
So,
right. Frankly, I don't have time for that today.
Well,
I don't think our listeners do either. So I appreciate your self-control.
Well, I'd like to think our listeners would just keep on listening. but I don't know.
Well, they might.
Yeah.
They might.
You know what you do have a choice to do, though? To become a patron.
Patron. Yeah. I thought that was, you were going to say something about that.
He finishes by saying, you see, God gives us the choices. It's up to us to make good ones. That is how I interpret free will.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
That's good.
Thanks for reading my long-winded email. Well,
sure
thanks
thing.
For sending your long-winded
yes,
email, David.
Thank you. Thank you.
We will read your long-winded emails anytime.
So. I think it takes way more time to compose the email than it does to read it. So
yeah.
More thanks, Dave. Yeah, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Thank you, Dave.
Yes, thank all of you for sending in your notes.
Absolutely.
It's my favorite part of the show. Well, I like the content too, but I always look forward to the correspondence. I like that you save it for the end.
I do look forward to the correspondence as well. Yep. Yeah. And on that note, we'd love to hear from each and every one of you.
Mm-hmm.
Again, TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, through the website, Facebook, Twitter, any way you can get to us. On our next episode, we will be taking a deep dive into the founding of Numenor. I know we've done a lot in the last year or so on the Second Age and on Numenor, but I was rereading the beginning of Caliphate recently,
mm-hmm.
and I was just like, I want to really talk about these first few pages of Akalabeth in a lot of detail.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to do on the next episode.
Perfecto.
Perfecto.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for listening.
Mm-hmm.
And a special thanks to our patrons, and especially the following patrons: Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Matt L.
Johanna T.
Todd G.
And Ms. Anonymous.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all very
yeah,
much.
Yeah, thanks to all of our patrons.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.